This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Merry Christmas or Feliz Navidad to everyone out there who celebrates. For today's show, we're going to be playing you a few of our favorite conversations from our Aging While Queer series. These are important, meaningful conversations to hear, especially around the holidays. So sit back, get some hot cocoa, and enjoy.
America is aging. According to data from the Urban Institute, the number of Americans over age 65 will double in the next 40 years. The number of adults over 85, which is the group who most often needs assistance in daily life, will quadruple. And by 2040, there will likely be 80 million older Americans. Honestly, I kind of can't wait because my generation is lit and we are going to be some fabulous old folk. Now, to be clear, my girls and I will be solidly in the over 65 demo in 2040. And yes, we will still be rocking out to Beyonce. We like to party. Not only will our generation be the most racially diverse seniors in American history, we will also be the most openly queer. In the coming decades, an estimated 10 million older adults will be LGBTQ identified. And with the graying of gay America come unique intersectional challenges. So we're kicking off our new series here on The Takeaway, Aging While Queer. To get us started, we're joined now by Michael Adams, CEO of SAGE, the country's largest and oldest organization dedicated to improving the lives of LGBTQ older people. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Melissa. It's good to be with you.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the unique challenges facing LGBTQ elders?
Absolutely. Our elders in our community face a range of challenges, among them being very high levels of social isolation and thin support networks. And this comes in part from the fact that so many of our elders are not parents for lots of historical reasons. In fact, as we grow older, we're four times less likely to be parents than older Americans in general, and twice as likely to grow older single and living alone. And of course, we live in a society where adult children and partners and spouses are primary caregivers in old age. So the absence of them creates a lot of isolation and thin support networks, which means as we age as queer elders, we have a greater need for professional services and care. But unfortunately, what we find is that often when we seek to access that care, what we find is discrimination, ignorance, lack of cultural competency. And these challenges are worse for queer elders of color, for trans elders, in terms of higher levels of poverty and in terms of the intersectionality of discrimination based on identity and life experience. So these are some of the challenges that our elders face as they get older.
It was occurring to me as we were working on the production of this segment that marriage equality has only been on the books since 2015. And marriage, even beyond the question of love, right, has been a question about the capacity to extend protective resources to those you love, things like your Social Security, so that if you live beyond your partner, that there are resources left to support your partner. And that is so brand new in queer communities that it means, right, not only the question of children, but even of lifelong partnership may not have extended those kind of fiscal supports.
Precisely. Well, marriage equality was a big breakthrough. Frankly, it came too late for many of today's elders in our community who are dealing with the accumulated impact of lifetimes of discrimination and marginalization in the same way that things like Social Security benefits accumulate, right? So if you're let into the door very late in life, sometimes that's just too late when it comes to financial supports and resources and the benefits that come with our country's so-called safety net, such as it is.
Now, also walk us a bit through discrimination, because I do think marriage equality is often a place where we both begin and end the conversation. And in a time when we're seeing LGBTQ youth being targeted by new legal restrictions, what are the kinds of vulnerabilities, like legal vulnerabilities, that still exist for LGBTQ elders?
Well, it's so important that we not end the conversation with marriage equality, because really for all of us, including our elders, it's just the beginning. And fundamentally, we still see substantial levels of discrimination against our elders. Let's start with housing. We know from both our experience at SAGE, and we work with tens of thousands of queer elders across the country, and from research, that there are very high levels of housing discrimination against our elders. In fact, a study several years ago found that 48% of LGBTQ older adults are subjected to discrimination when they apply for senior rental housing. 48%, that's an incredibly, incredibly high number. We also know there are high levels of discrimination against LGBTQ older folks in long-term care. And by that, I mean things like nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and things of that nature. These levels of discrimination mean that our elders have a justified fear in terms of how they will be treated in senior housing settings and elder care settings. And what that means for many of our elders is that they feel forced back into the closet as a self-protective mechanism, right? Too, because they're at a point in life where in many cases they may be more vulnerable, less able to advocate for themselves, and feel that they can't take on that additional vulnerability of being out. So this self-closeting dynamic takes place for many of our older folks, especially who are in institutional care or working with home care attendants, which is really a tragedy that has to come to an end.
All right, let's pick up on this question of long-term care, Michael. What is the Long-Term Care Bill of Rights?
So a Long-Term Care Bill of Rights is model legislation promoted by SAGE and now adopted in a number of states and jurisdictions around the country that guarantees that queer elders will be treated with the dignity and respect that they deserve when they're in long-term care settings like nursing homes, like assisted living. So the Long-Term Care Bill of Rights guarantees that our elders are protected from discrimination. It guarantees that their gender choices will be protected and respected in things like room assignments and in the pronouns that long-term care staff use, that they will use our folks' preferred pronouns. It guarantees that same gender loving relationships will be respected in long-term care and things of that nature. And so gradually, we're seeing more and more states and jurisdictions, states like California, New Jersey, the District of Columbia, adopt these long-term care bills of rights in order to make sure that our elders are treated with just the fundamental respect they deserve in their later years if they're in long-term care.
Now, is that connected to the Equality Act?
It's absolutely connected to the Equality Act. The Equality Act is a proposed federal legislation that would provide federal anti-discrimination protections to queer elders all across this country in housing and elder care and elder services. And it is an essential bill that must be passed, because the challenge is without the Equality Act, we have to enact these protections on a state-by-state basis. And I think we all know that in some parts of this country, that's going to be extraordinarily difficult. So the Equality Act is fundamentally important. It's been passed by the House of Representatives, and we're pushing hard to get the Senate to pass it as well.
So it's actually, I'm curious about whether or not you even have data on this issue. But as you say that, and you're talking about the state by state, as a Southerner, I'm thinking also a little bit about rural versus urban experiences. And we just lost my own godmother to Alzheimer's. And at the very end, she was in a long-term care facility. And we were navigating even the issues of race, you know, and in the South, in places where there are high populations of African Americans, but where you're still sort of in each facility trying to check and ensure that your elder will be cared for in a way that doesn't reflect those generational biases. So I'm wondering, if you all know, either by region or by the urban-rural divide, where LGBTQ elders may be facing the harshest concerns in long-term care facilities.
I'm really glad that you're raising this question, Melissa, because in some ways it gets at the heart of an intersectional approach to this conversation around issues like race, like rural versus urban. So one thing, for example, there tends to be this misconception that, queer folks live primarily or exclusively in urban areas. Not true. An AARP survey from several years ago showed that just under 30% of LGBTQ elders live in rural areas, and 9 out of 10 of them report that they have access to absolutely no queer-friendly services or care. And then we layer race and racism into that. And so we know, and of course, COVID put a spotlight on this in an incredibly dramatic way. We see tremendous disparities in health and health care, higher levels of discrimination. For example, during the COVID era, you referenced Alzheimer's. We saw that Black folks living with Alzheimer's are twice as likely to die from COVID as white people living with Alzheimer's. So these layers of experience, which include importantly where you live, both rural versus urban, and in what parts of the country, red versus blue or purple, and race, of course, tremendously complicate the experience that queer elders have as they age. And part of our policy agenda has to be to ensure that we enact things like the Equality Act and undertake other strategies to ensure that the progress we're making, the protections we're advancing, don't just reach queer elders in urban areas or in blue states or blue areas, but reach queer elders everywhere.
What can you tell us about the housing that SAGE provides in Fort Greene and in the Bronx in New York?
So one of the things that we hear from our elders is that some of the places where they feel least safe as LGBTQ people and the most need to hide who they are is where they live, right? Which is truly, truly wrong. So there is a movement in this country to create queer-specific, LGBTQ-focused elder housing with a strong focus on affordability. And SAGE has been part of the vanguard of that movement. And in recent years, we have built New York City and New York State's first two LGBTQ-friendly affordable housing developments, one in the Fort Greene neighborhood in Brooklyn, the other in the Crotona neighborhood in the Bronx. There are a variety of reasons why these two housing communities are important. But one of them is that we have been very intentional about locating these housing developments in historical communities of color.
Michael Adams, CEO of SAGE, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Dr. Imani Woody is about to break ground on a project long in the making. After Dr. Woody's father fell ill, her family moved him into what they thought was a good home, where they quickly discovered how poorly seniors are treated, regardless of how much you pay to have good care. Dr. Woody decided to create a safe space for the aging members of the LGBTQ SLG community. And after more than a decade of planning and fundraising, Mary's House is scheduled to open its doors in 2023. Dr. Imani Woody, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much, Melissa. I'm happy to be here.
Now tell me, what is Mary's House?
So it's Mary's House for older adults. We started with my dad taking ill and we having to put him in a facility. And it occurred to me, if he had been an out gay man, what would the treatment have been? Had he been an out trans person, what would the treatment have been? When, as a older adult cisgendered male, we put him in this facility continent and we pulled him out and he was incontinent. And so I wondered, in old age, it's so hard to be old and gay, really, those two, the intersectionality of aging and LGBTQ, SGL, same gender loving, can be horrific. And it shouldn't be in your golden years, right, Melissa? We should be able to enjoy ourselves, not worrying about how we are being perceived because of one of our intersectionalities. So Mary's House, the thought of it was born. I had my kitchen cabinet around, my pop died, left me the house. And I said, you know, what should we do with the house? The house is in Washington, D.C. And so we thought and came up with the idea, let's create housing, because across the nation, you know, there's a dearth of housing, affordable housing. I mean, if you're rich, You can live anywhere. If you're wealthy, you can live pretty much where you want. And so, but what do you do when you're just a regular Joe, Jane, Marquita? Where do you go? And so we said, let's build this housing. And that was the vision, and we're close.
I got to say, as I'm listening to you talk, I realize how much 10 or 15 years ago, this would have felt so abstract to me. And now I find myself fully in the middle of the sandwich, right? With, you know, young kids on one hand and truly aging elderly parents on the other, and beginning to face all of those questions and realizing that when we talk about housing discrimination, when we talk about poverty so often, even though we don't say it, we're actually talking about young people, or we're talking about relatively young families. And as much as we think about many different intersections of invisibility, I'm realizing how much I haven't bothered to see how all of these questions are perhaps even more crucial for our seniors and for our older population.
Yes, I think that's true for many of us. I am older now, and I'm feeling the impact of aging and ageism, and I'm female. So it's hard. It's hard. And so I understand when you say you feel it. You know, it really comes to fruition when it comes in your backyard or becomes you. You really feel it, right? And so I understand that.
Now, I'm also interested in the point that you make here about, on the one hand, when we do think about any of these questions, maybe we think about them in the context of poverty. But for older Americans, it's not necessarily about being poor. Ordinary folk, right? Folks who have been working class, middle class their whole lives, but once they are on fixed incomes and we see the cost of housing skyrocketing, for example, as it has in the post-COVID era, or we experience the realities of gentrification, having truly safe and supportive housing for those with marginal identities gets harder and harder. So talk to me about what it means, at least to you and to Mary's house, when you say safe and supportive LGBTQ plus elder housing.
Okay, so when I say safe and affordable housing for LGBTQ, same gender loving folks, I mean that you can put the key in the door and you're welcome. You can bring your whole self, whole self, into the frame. That's your old self. No one's going to be condescending. We do a lot of that with our elders. No one's going to talk down to you. So you can bring your old self. You can bring your ethnic self, your Black self, your Jewish self. It means that you can bring all layers of you to a place and you won't feel any way. Like Melissa, you know, there's some kind of way folks can make other folks feel, and you can't put your finger on it. And you're trying to figure out, well, is that because I'm old? Is that because I'm lesbian? Is that because I'm trans? Is that because I'm poor? You know, you're trying to figure out where affordable housing, in my opinion, your castle, where you lay your head and sleep and shut out the rest of the world, embraces you, envelops you, affirms you.
So talk to me a little bit about the education and training that goes into creating affirming housing.
My PhD is in human services, nonprofit management, and I'm building housing. So that's first. I didn't know what I didn't know until I was in the belly of the beast. It's not for the faint of heart. It's for if you have a passion. Because in many instances, affordable housing doesn't make a lot of money. With Mary's House for Older Adults, we're not going to get rich with this. It's going to sustain itself. The individual needs a passion and a persistence to move forward and get to the finish line.
Look at how your love for your father, your reflection on the realities of these intersectional identities just might change the way that seniors live all around the world. Dr. Imani Woody, thank you for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. The population of Puerto Rico is at its lowest point in 40 years. Hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans have left the island for mainland U.S., an exodus that accelerated after the widespread devastation of Hurricane Maria in 2017. The remaining population on the island tends to be older. More than one in five Puerto Rican residents is 65 or older. And as we continue our ongoing series, Aging While Queer, we're looking at life for older LGBTQ plus Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico. I spoke with Wilfred Labiosa, Executive Director of Waves Ahead, an organization that supports queer elders in Puerto Rico.
I lived in Massachusetts for over 27 years, and due to a family health situation with my mom and dad, I moved back to my homeland, to Puerto Rico. And here in Puerto Rico, I noticed right away that there is a significant difference on treatment, not only from the health sector, but also in the housing sector, in all the different sectors that impact the lives of our LGBT elders and LGBT community as a whole, from how you are left to wait for an appointment for hours at a time, to significant issues and discrimination in regards of housing, accessibility to food, etc.
So as you made that transition and saw those injustices, tell me a bit about particularly the position of elders within the community, given those inequities.
Well, in Puerto Rico has been faced with an economical crisis for the last 8 years. And right now we have a supervision board given by the United States to Puerto Rico, enforced to Puerto Rico, to manage their economical crisis. Since then, you have seen the impact in each of the individuals' pockets, specifically our elders. The elders have been impacted because the increase in medication copays, in medical visits, as well as in rents, etc. The impact of the hurricanes at the fall of 2017 made it worse. And then the earthquakes, then COVID. So it has been one situation after another that has impacted the economical day-to-day expenses of our elders. Our elders that are LGBT live for the most part alone, may or may not have a partner, and may or may not have children themselves. So they're living not only in San Juan, but across the island, that makes them hard to transport themselves into accessing services. And so you see how the transportation starts to impact because the individuals have to pay extra to use one of these platforms to acquire a private driver in one of those companies. And it starts then in the pharmacy, then it continues in the food, because all of our export and imports have been impacted by the hurricanes and then the earthquakes and now COVID, really the accessibility to products have lowered themselves. So sometimes you go to the supermarket and you may not have X or Y product. And when it gets to the supermarket, you have to pay double or triple the price that you would expect normally for that same product.
So you began in responding to that by talking about the kind of ongoing economic crisis, onto which, of course, fell Hurricane Maria and the earthquakes and the COVID pandemic. But these things didn't just happen. They are largely a result, or at least many would argue, of policy of the mainland U.S. relative to Puerto Rico. I'm wondering, as you look at that relationship, sort of how you see where the responsibilities might lie for those economic crises and their disparate impact on LGBTQ plus elders.
Yes, your statement is one that one needs to sit and really see that our elected officials from the federal level to the local level have impacted in the long run and now today the policies and procedures and the income tax and the tax breaks that have been given to the rich and not to the everyday living citizen. Here in Puerto Rico, we have a Jones Act that really impacts still till today our pockets, and especially our elders, because the expenses go up, but the benefits that they have, the retirement could be, or it could be Social Security, have not gone up. So really the cost of living has increased because of all these politicians doing these policies, but the benefits and the earnings of these elders that may not work any longer keeps the same or have been lower.
Tell me a little bit about your organization, Waves Ahead, and its mission.
Sure. Waves Ahead became, I developed this organization with other individuals here in Puerto Rico because we wanted to dedicate ourselves in supporting these marginalized and vulnerable sectors of Puerto Rico by providing them the aid necessary to stabilize them and to strengthen them. And the main focus is the LGBT elders. We are an affiliate of SAGE, and we manage SAGE in Puerto Rico, providing advocacy and services to the LGBT elders from our three community centers focused on the LGBT elder, but also providing services to the LGBT general community as well as the elder general community. Our three centers, our goal is to be able to be in each part of the island so that from the centers we can provide them now during COVID especially to their home-based services, as well as services by the platforms in computer or by the phone or in a way hybrid. So if they feel comfortable coming to our centers, they can come. And if they can reach us, they can come or we go to them.
Talk to me about the specific mental health needs and concerns that you have experienced and seen as part of the work you've been doing with Waves Ahead.
As a healthcare provider myself, and definitely I'm a trained clinical social worker, I have seen the impact after the hurricane in our mental health, of everybody in mental health here in Puerto Rico. We are, many of us could go through a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder because it has been one after another. And interesting enough, we have developed a campaign to educate individuals about, to take away the taboo about mental health, that preventive ways to be able to take care of our mental health. Interestingly enough, statistics show in Puerto Rico that suicide attempts and death by suicide is largely over 80% in the older adult. It's very different in the States. In the States, this statistics is reflected among youth because of the bullying, because of all the different stressors that happen in society when you may come out of the closet or your daily living as a young person. Well, those same stressors, and even to a higher level, are impacting the older adult here in Puerto Rico, and they are using more mental health services. They're accessing emergency services because of their mental health, not so much their physical health, and they are unfortunately, you know, attempting suicide or dying by suicide. And that's a very interesting topic because our culture dictates that you only go to a therapist, a mental health therapist, when you are quote unquote crazy or when you have an addiction disorder. And we have created that in our society culturally, that is a taboo, that you only access these services. We want to promote mental health as a way to take care of it preventively, to talk about your issues on a daily way that is impacting your life, because we don't want to continue perpetuating that there is so much trauma not being addressed, not being talked about, and that it could be a worse situation later on. That's why we not only provide mental health sessions individually to partners, family, but we also provide yoga and meditation, groups of mindfulness, music therapy, creative arts, even time to come and play board games, to really socialize and to meet other ones like themselves. Of course, COVID has impacted many of our programming, but we have brought them all to them by platforms, by phones, so that they can participate. We only closed our doors for one day during the pandemic to do this transition. We even have provided technology to the elders, trainings to them, so that they can join in these groups that help their mental health. Because it is so important to take care of our mental health because it impacts your physical health.
So we've talked here a little bit, or you mentioned obviously the great challenge and problem of suicides, but there is also the very stark reality of homicides, and particularly against transgender members of the community. Can you say a few words about that?
It is an issue that we need to continue talking, and it's sad that we have to talk about this issue that is impacting not only Puerto Rico, but also the world in regards of the homicides against our brothers and sisters who are from the transgender community. There has to be a dialogue about the racism, about the classism and sexism, and the LGBT phobia that exists in our world, specifically here in, culturally based in Puerto Rico. And it's also sad to say that the local authorities do not put attention to these homicides as they should. And so many of the cases that have happened in the last 2 years have been put under the table in a drawer and put away and not investigated to the extent that they should be investigated. We are continuing advocating and reminding the officials in the police department, into the FBI, about the importance of looking to these crimes as hate crimes. But the local government does not want to classify them as hate crime because then the FBI would come in and hopefully would solve the situation. But there is always give or take by the central government about and the police officials, local officials, to categorize them as what they are, is a hate crime. Simple as that, is a hate crime.
Can you give me a vision? Given your organization, the work that you're doing, your acknowledgement of the challenges in everything from infrastructure to mental health to hate crimes, if you could imagine the Puerto Rico that you want for LGBTQ plus communities, and particularly for the elders in that community, what would it look like, say, 10 years out for you?
Wow, it's a complex question, of course, but I know and I accept we are so resilient. No matter what everybody says, we are resilient. Our LGBT elders are so much into the community. They're so engaged with us, with everybody. So 10 years from now, I see a community that it will be stronger, that it will take ownership of the votes that have been gone wasted, that we will change our minds and we will get educated to put into office officials that accept the diversity and our intersectionalities. And I'm hopeful for a future that will include, no matter what, the LGBT older community and our diversity. So I'm very hopeful for Puerto Rico. I'm very hopeful for our future. And that is one of the reasons I moved here, because I see hope. I see hope and I see the resiliency in each one of us. And we can make a difference.
Wilfred Labiosa is the executive director of Waves Ahead. Wilfred, thanks so much.
Thank you. Gracias.
When I walked back out of the clinic, it felt like I was walking into Oz. Like I walked down into camp from Kansas into that clinic and then came back out, and it was like Oz. Everything was electrified. I mean, the sounds were brighter, a lot louder. The sky was bluer. The greens were greener. Everything was, the birds were chirping really loud. And much later on, I realized that was, you know, shock.
This is Tez Anderson. He's one of the more than a million Americans currently living with HIV. He was first diagnosed positive in 1986, and that was a time when, on average, an AIDS patient died within 15 months of diagnosis. Tez was only 26 years old when he received the news that made the world feel like Oz, buzzing with shock.
Nearly 35 years later, Tez Anderson is still living, loving, and working. And today, the landscape of HIV is quite different. With the right medications, long-term treatments, and moderate lifestyle adjustments like nutrition and sleep regularity, people with HIV can expect to live just as long as their counterparts who are negative. New antiretroviral therapies, or ART, can make HIV viral load undetectable, meaning that someone who's HIV positive cannot pass the infection to others. And together with the effective use of PrEP for PrEP medications for HIV negative individuals, HIV is no longer a death sentence or a sentence to loneliness. But for those who survived the most brutal decades of the pandemic, there are costs to surviving. The loss of so many friends and loved ones, years spent preparing for death rather than building life, and the challenges of living to an age you never thought you'd reach. For this installment of our takeaway series, Aging While Queer, we spoke with Tez and began with the shock of his initial diagnosis.
And everyone was dying. And the fact was that 10 years later, I realized that I actually seroconverted and became HIV positive in 1983, because I was dating a guy that died from something mysterious. We didn't know what it was, and we lost touch because he lived out of town. And he was having something going on with his blood, and he sent me a letter saying, I'm going through some changes lately, to the tune of about 35 pounds less. And that was the last letter I ever got from him. And I remember that summer was when I had all the symptoms of seroconversion, but it took me a long time to put that together. I was diagnosed in 86. I've been living with the virus since 1983.
And so here you are, decades later, not gone. I'm wondering if the Oz effect is still in effect, maybe particularly in the moment of the pandemic crisis. I'm wondering about whether or not there was a renewed sense of shock and terror.
You know, at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, there was a little bit of echoes from the early days of the pandemic, of the HIV pandemic. I mean, it's funny, I was in Washington, D.C. this past week, and a bus road drive about ending the pandemic. And I'm like, which one? You know, because I've lived through two now. So at first there was shocks of the early days of AIDS, because no one knew how it was transmitted and that sort of stuff. But that didn't last very long because they're very different viruses. And also because when HIV first arrived, no one noticed, no one gave a damn. And it was buried on the back page of the New York Times. And it was a very small news. With COVID, everybody was involved. It was much more infectious, of course. So there's similarities, but there's very big differences too. But at the beginning, yeah, I was like, oh my God, here we go again. Mm.
I actually turned in those early days to some of my friends and colleagues who are HIV positive to ask them specifically about, you know, how to think about and talk about what it meant to be in a contagious public health crisis. And I mean, given that literally some of the players on the national stage, like Fauci, were the same actual players, right? What we needed to be thinking about and looking for that maybe we missed in the 80s.
I mean, the thing was that there really is no group of people who know more about surviving a pandemic than HIV long-term survivors. I mean, there's 1.1 or 1.2 million people in the U.S. now living with HIV, and over half of them are over 50, quarter of them. 25% are long-term survivors like myself, who were diagnosed at a time before there were effective medications. In fact, when I was diagnosed, there were no medications, and you know, people were dying. I think the kind of swimming upstream feeling that the people were getting during COVID, and the panic and the sheer confusion and terror that they were feeling, was something that we were familiar with and had navigated our way through, most of us. I mean, it's interesting how in the early days of the COVID pandemic, it brought up a lot of stuff from the early pandemic. But for me, when I first found out I was positive, I decided to be the best dying guy in the world. How about books on death and dying? And I plunged myself into the idea that I was going to die. And I lived that way for 20 years. I mean, I went back to the doctor after the first 2 years and he said, 2 more years. I was like, okay, well, readjust there. And we did that for a decade. And I finally said, you don't really have any idea what you're talking about, do you? And he said, well, not exactly. And I said, well, then stop telling people they're dying, because they make plans to die, not plans to live. And at some point, that very idea that dying, I can wrap my brain around, because it was logical. It was why we were put on Earth for one reason, to eventually die. What we do with that time is ours, but I'm just saying that we all going to, it's all the same end point. And for me, I realized that I had to kind of, I don't know, step up to the plate and live as well as I could live.
Tez Anderson, thank you so much for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa. It's lovely to be with you.
We're continuing our hour-long coverage about the aging LGBTQ plus community, and you're going to love this next story. This is a conversation I had with Pat and Paulette Martin, who are both LGBTQ community activists. Now, Paulette Martin knew she was a lesbian from a young age, but she didn't feel safe enough to fully be her authentic self until later in life. She married a man and raised 3 children, and then finally in her 40s, she came out. Today, Paulette is happily married to Pat Martin, and while coming out was also a challenge for Pat, most of her family quickly accepted her after she came out as a teenager. I started by talking with Paulette about her childhood.
It was a time where I didn't have a voice. I couldn't truly say that I was attracted to girls. I didn't have the word gay at that time in my vocabulary. I just knew that I liked girls and I liked the comfort and being around the softness, but I wasn't able to share that. So I buried it and I felt that I'll do the norm, which was to get married, have children, build a family. And underneath all of that, I was not happy. I felt like I can do this for a moment in time and that too shall pass. That moment lasted a long time, like 20 years, but it was never one of peace. So it was okay that someone else had a gay family member. I went to an all-girls school. There were gay people in school, but when they got home to the neighborhood, they became straight.
That kind of duality, that that multiplicity and sort of being able, like, I can perform this, but who I truly am is someone else. Pat, to what extent does that resonate with your own story?
Well, you know, most of my family, I knew that I was gay. The only one who I think she knew, but she was just in total denial, was my mother. My family also had gay friends. The person that did my hair growing up was a gay man, and he was totally accepted in our house at any time. When they would do the weekend fish fries, he was there. But my mother just always said, if one of my children grow up to be in the, and the word at that time was bulldigger, if one of my children grow up to be a bulldigger, I'll kill them. And as she said it, she always looked at me. So that tells me that she knew, and she was just trying to give me a warning that I better not come out.
Pat, what do you make of that? That kind of strange dichotomy between being willing to love and know and welcome into the family fish fry someone who is gay, but also that intensity of opposition to your own child being gay.
I think it is that stigma, that thing where if my child is gay, I did something wrong. It's a reflection on me. So if the world see that one of mine is gay, then I didn't do my job by bringing a girl into the world.
It is true. We can pretty easily over-identify with our kids in ways that make their lives just about us. And yet, Pat and Paulette, the two of you found each other. Can you tell me your love story?
Well, I have always been an event planner. So I had brought together a team and we were preparing to do a women's dance. And Sage Center Harlem was giving us space to meet. And this was like, I think the night before the dance. So we were packing up our swag bag and Paulette had volunteered to help fill the swag bags. And during my meeting, my team were getting a little nervous and they were saying some stuff that was rather upsetting. And Paulette chimed in and she said, "Can I say something? Go ahead, babe, you do it."
From that point, what I noticed was that Pat had a plan. I could see her vision. And they didn't. So I asked if I could interject and told them that since Pat knew what she was saying, and I didn't know her background, I didn't know her, first time meeting her, that they should be in submission to her. So Pat, eyebrow raised, like, "Oh, okay." And then she had the dance the next night and everything was fine. I had her number. I had also prepared some food for the event. And so when the dance was over, I actually deleted her phone number because I felt like I needed to clean my phone out and we were done with our business. So she attended one of my church's event to support one of the ministers there who was doing the sermon that day. And we sat together and I remember that every time her leg touched mine, it was like, "Oh my goodness, I'm in church. Stop it." So it was so exciting. So when we left church, I had informed her, I didn't have her number. She had said, "Well, call me." And I said, "Well, I deleted it." So she gave me her business card and she said, "Don't delete it." So that next weekend, I was dressed, looking good, wanted someone on my arm to go out to Henrietta Hudson. So I called her and asked her out. She said yes. And then she proceeded to call me back with a message saying that she couldn't go. That was her way of getting me back for losing her number. And I called her back and said, "When a lady asks you out, you do not refuse them." So we went to Henrietta Hudson. She met me there. We went there. And Pat, take it away.
Yeah, she wore me down, Melissa. And we've been together ever since.
Tell me about Milk.
Oh, you're touching my heart now, right? Milk is Masculine Identified Lesbians of Color Collective. It's an organization that supports other masculine identified lesbians of color. We found that there's so much available to our white counterparts, and we needed to do something that we could identify with. So I got together with some of my buddies and we created Milk. And we do workshops, we do symposiums, we do our sip and chat. It's a safe space for lesbians of color who identify as masculine identified and masculine of center lesbians.
The purpose and the passion of Pat and of Paulette Martin, the love that you clearly have for each other, that you've shown to your community, that you have engaged through Milk organizing. Thank you so much for living your best lives and for sharing them with us.
Oh, our pleasure.
That's the show, y'all. We really hope you enjoyed it. And please continue to tune in because our Aging While Queer series is not over yet. We have so much more to come in the new year. Now, if you missed today's show or you want to listen back again, check out our podcast. You know the drill. It's available wherever you find your audio or head on over to thetakeaway.org. And of course, call us with show ideas and suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Stay safe out there, enjoy the holiday, and come
come on back on Monday.